On our minds this week, maybe you saw the recent news that a computer passed the famous Turing test for the first time. That's the test to see if a computer can trick people into thinking they're talking with another person. There's actually some debate about whether the computer known as Eugene really did pass the Turing test, but there's no doubt the clever quotient for computers is ramping up. Are they actually smarter than we are? And are they changing the way we think? Journalist Clive Thompson tracks new technology as a columnist for Wired magazine, and his book, Smarter Than You Think, is just out in paper. Steve Paulson caught up with him.
Clive, you start your book with the question, who's better at chess, computers or humans? And I think most of us thought that we knew the answer. It was computers ever since the IBM computer Deep Blue beat the world champion Garry Kasparov back in 1997. But you have a more complicated answer than that. Why are you interested in this question?
Well, the reason why I like the story of computer chess is because I found it was sort of a great metaphor for what's happening to our relationship to technology in everyday life. Because, as you know, right after Deep Blue beat Kasparov, everyone thought, okay, that's it. Chess is over. Let's just fold up and go home. Because a computer is not playing chess the way that a human does. Kasparov is sitting there and he's trying to sort of pull his decades of intuition to think of the best move. But Deep Blue was just doing this very straightforward brute force attack. You know, figure the best move, 8 moves out, pick that, recalculate over and over again. And, you know, Kasparov knew eventually he was going to lose to something like that because human intelligence doesn't work that way.
We just don't have the calculating power.
Yes, exactly. So Kasparov had a much more interesting reaction that very few people know about. What he did is he said, well, let's take a look at the fact that computers think, quote-unquote think, in a different way from humans. Maybe we can do something fun with this. Instead of having them fight each other, why don't we have them collaborate? And so he invented advanced chess, where a grandmaster would sit down with a laptop and face off against another grandmaster with a laptop. And they were allowed to use it as they wanted. They would program the chess pieces into the computer, see what the software recommended, consult databases of older games. And it was fast chess, 60-minute chess, you know, speed chess. So they couldn't sit there forever. And what happened was that the chess became explosively creative because they suddenly freed to do things they would never have dared to do otherwise.
And so you're saying that humans with the computers together could beat a really good computer. I mean, the humans still had something to add to this
equation. Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. In fact, the really crazy thing was that it turned out that you didn't have to be a grandmaster to excel at this type of chess. You could be just a really good amateur. They had one competition where a couple of New England relative amateurs beat everyone, and they in fact played against a supercomputer that was playing on its own that was stronger than Deep Blue. So basically, these two kids played chess better than Kasparov played against Deep Blue.
So why? I mean, what is it that humans can bring to the game of chess that a computer itself can't do?
Intuition. It turned out the best teams were the ones that understood when to ignore what the computer was suggesting because they could do something that would freak out the human across the table, right? And that's how they got so good at it.
Now, I know that you're interested in this chess example, not just because you're a chess fan, but this is a kind of metaphor for how you see technology generally. I mean, it sounds like you're saying it's not that technology is going to displace humans, but if humans can use technology in the right way, the sky's the limit.
Absolutely, yeah. You said something quite key there, which is if they can learn how to use it. I mean, you're not just going to necessarily become smarter because you've got a smartphone in your pocket. You have to learn how to use it well. And this is a challenge that we faced over and over and over again. You know, like libraries came along and it wasn't intuitive at all exactly how they should be set up. It took us a couple hundred years to get the Dewey Decimal System in place, you know, to organize a library. Before then, they were just a jumble and the students would show up and they could not get anything out of it. So we're in the process now where we have these unbelievable tools for thought and we're beginning to realize we have to grapple with learning how to use them.
But, you know, there is now a kind of cottage industry of books coming out saying, watch out for all this new technology. And the people who write these are not dumb about technology. I mean, Nicholas Carr said that we're losing the ability to read and think deeply. Jaron Lanier says that technology is on the verge of displacing the middle class. There are lots of other people who say that we're becoming so dependent on technology that computer algorithms are going to dictate what we do, you know, what we buy, the news we consume, what entertainment we seek out. I take it that you don't think much about these complaints.
Well, you know, some of them I agree with. Nick Carr did an enormous service to the world by decisively dismantling and attacking the idea that multitasking is a good thing, right? There was this idea that, you know, if you had 17 windows open on your computer, you were somehow operating at peak intellectual efficiency. There was something sort of glorious about that. But what he demonstrated, and which is absolutely true, is that no, if you're being constantly interrupted and trying to do 40 things at once, you will do none of it well. You
if
know?
You keep checking your email every 10 minutes, you're just not going to get anything
if
done.
If you're flipping to Facebook and then going back to the report on Twitter, it's disastrous for the attention span.
So just to follow up on that point, attention span, how do you deal with that in your own life?
Oh,
I mean, because
sure.
you have all these gadgets at your fingertips. So what do you do?
Well, I do a couple things. One is that I do email in bursts. I don't keep it open all day long. I pick a couple times a day to go through it, because if you just sit there, it'll ding every 30 seconds and you will always stop and go what you're doing. Same type of thing with Twitter or Facebook. I don't leave them open all the time in the background. And then on the weekends, I just go pretty much entirely offline. I stop checking my email on Friday night and I don't check it again until, you know, Monday morning. Because there are types of thinking, creative thinking, that only come when you're on that long walk after having spent 4 hours reading a deep book. The thing that I disagree with Carr and other people is that they will say, no, your brain is permanently damaged and you cannot find a balance. I don't think that's true.
Now, one thing that you talk about in your book is what you call ambient awareness. What do you mean by that?
Ambient awareness is a really interesting concept. What starts happening when we begin using this very short-form media, like these sort of seemingly silly little utterances, you know, each tweet, each Instagram update, each Snapchat, each Facebook status update, they all seem so small on their own. And anytime a social critic wants to say, you know, Western society's decline is here, they will find an individual tweet and say, you know, look how
stupid. And there's plenty of evidence.
Exactly. Look at this dumb tweet. You know, I've written them myself. But the point about these media is that they gain enormous power in the aggregate. If you talk to anyone for their first week on Twitter, they'll be like, the first day is like, why am I doing this? This is silly. After about a week, they're like, I see, yeah, this person, you know, talks about this a lot. That's kind of interesting. This person does these pictures. It's kind of interesting. Then after a year, they've been following these people. They have this unbelievably ESP-like glimpse into what this person has been thinking about, what they've been worrying about. And that connection is fantastic, because it allows you to understand the internal and intellectual lives of other people in such a way that it enhances when you meet them face to face. It gives you more access to, oh, I think I know who could answer this for me. It lets you see and encounter in a serendipitous way pieces of knowledge that you would never have seen on your own. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the most interesting and most, I think, ill understood aspects of modern short-form media. We're accustomed to assessing utterances, particularly written utterances, we're accustomed to assessing them at the level of the individual utterances. We're not accustomed to assessing them in aggregate.
Hmm. We should talk some about what all this means for education, because as we know, more and more schools are trying to get computers into every classroom, iPads to every student if money is available. Is this a good thing?
I'm torn. I visited a lot of schools where I saw a lot of money blown on technology that did not seem to be having any impact on learning at all. So, you know, you have all these, you know, whiteboards that are $12,000 that are really no significant improvement over a chalkboard. You have people using iPads to do, you know, finger painting, when it strikes me that, you know, $1 finger paints, you know,
right,
actually do that probably better, you know, because they get into the tactile stuff. So what I learned from talking to the teachers, and they all told me that there were amazing things they'd done, and they all basically were pretty much free. It was all like simple stuff, like, how do you get your kids to read and write more? Well, get them to read and then blog about it in front of the public, the whole world. Hmm. And when it goes before the whole world, oh my goodness, they panic and they work harder and they write longer, because they're willing to sort of phone it in for the teacher, because who really cares? It's just a teacher. But if it's going to go in front of the world and their friends and their parents, they suddenly freak out. They're writing 40% longer. They're writing more lexically complicated. They're doing
if their friends are actually going to check what they wrote that's on. Line.
Oh, it's not even friends. Actually, it's strangers. I mean, this is the thing. Like, you'd get people, this one school that did this in New Zealand actively sent out notes saying, all right, parents and relatives all around the world, we want you to check and comment on this stuff. So they're getting comments from Germany, New York, and stuff like that. And they were enthralled, and they had never written so much or so well in their lives.
So you're saying you still need teachers. It's just that teachers can, with these tools, can be more effective.
In fact, actually, you not only need teachers, you need teachers who are going to work harder than ever before, because it's very easy to sit in front of a class and give the same lecture to everyone and lose 50% of them. It's very hard to customize your learning to 20 or 30 kids in your class. So these teachers I talked to, they were knocking themselves out. I think they should all be given raises, if you ask me. And I specifically went to schools that were not in wealthy areas, some that actually had really troubled kids from ESL backgrounds, and they were doubling their scores over a period of a few months because of the amount of one-on-one they were able to get in math. I mean, this is stuff I'd never seen anywhere before. So yeah, when teachers get it and they understand how to use it, they can do it for cheap and for free, and they can have fantastic results.
Clive Thompson is a columnist for Wired Magazine and author of Smarter Than You Think: How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. He spoke with Steve Paulson.